One thing about me is that I'm mortal, like I'm an organism, which is weird on its own. Like I'm a collection of literal atoms that decided to hang out together for a while and which will eventually be unable to hang out together any longer. And then I will, this is the weirdest part, cease to be. And there's nothing that can be done about that because, like, planets and stars also cease to be. It's a real conundrum, and I'm not going to find my way through it in this advertisement. But we can make life less terrible for those who survive us, and that's why there's life insurance. I have life insurance because the people who are counting on me will be supported after my atoms can no longer hold it together, and Policy Genius is here to make life insurance easier. Policy Genius isn't an insurance company, it's a marketplace where buying insurance is straightforward and affordable. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams, so check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John. That's the wrong podcast. Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John, As you could tell by my intro, I'm a little bit hungover right now and maybe a little bit slower than usual. Catherine and I both recently had our birthdays, and this weekend, to celebrate them, our friends took us to this gorgeous vineyard in Missoula where people who can afford $10 glasses of wine get together and commiserate and talk about all the difficulties and hardships of their life, which I guess is why they call it a winery.
Did you actually go to a winery?
I did.
Okay. That makes me feel better about the joke. I'm trying to just lean in and laugh at your jokes instead of resisting them.
I worked on that one for a while. I felt a little bad about it because it was actually really lovely. And we didn't whine that much, but I just needed a joke.
We did whine. It was a good joke.
About various things.
Hank, can I read you some reviews that have come in the last 5 minutes.
Before you do, I just want to say that the intro that I accidentally started with, that's the intro to our Patreon-only podcast, This Week in Stuff, half of it before I realized, which you can be a part of at patreon.com/DearHankAndJohn. Anyway, John, your book is out. Congratulations.
Yeah, and by the way, that's what we're focusing on today, not the Patreon for This Week in Stuff. So if you make only one Green Brothers related purchase this week, don't join our Patreon. Buy my book. Our Patreon doesn't come with a book. The book does.
Uh-huh.
So as we're recording this, it's the day before the book comes out, which is, like, in general, in my experience of this being the sixth time I've done this, the most challenging, like emotionally challenging day. Because nothing has happened yet, but things are about to happen, or maybe not, you know?
Yeah.
And my stress level has been extremely high, but then I got this review from the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's so nice. So I'm just going to read a little bit of it to you, like the way that you do when you are a little brother and you want to make your older brother finally feel proud of you, and just because you're younger doesn't mean that you're not basically the older brother. So
I see.
As a premise, it's clever, and in the hands of another writer, the conceit might stop at cute, but Green is a ravenous and tender polymath. Can we talk about the fact, by the way, that ravenous and tender don't generally get followed by polymath?
No, or by each other.
Anyway, but honestly, that might be the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
Yeah, you need to change your Twitter bio right now.
I'm not sure I need to change my Twitter bio, but I know what you mean.
Can I change my Twitter bio to ravenous and tender polymath? Because I've stolen a lot from you over the years. Might as well
you
take
can't.
This too. Oh,
you can't, okay. But you can say brother of noted ravenous and tender polymath John Green if you want to. That's okay. These tiny essays are like winding mountain passes that lead you through unexpected landscapes, both in subject and in emotion. His reviews create a collage of factoids and a window into one person's longing, fears, and hope. And then the ending is so nice. The book makes the wondrous small, see his essay on Halley's Comet, and the small wondrous, like his ode to scratch and sniff stickers. The Anthropocene Reviewed is the perfect book to read over lunch or to keep on your nightstand whenever you need a reminder of what it is to feel small and human in the best possible way. That was so nice. That made me so happy. And it was just really, because I, almost no one has read the book, like certainly nobody I don't know has read the book. It just, for that to be the first thing that I get to read about, it was really just lovely. So that's thank you, person at the San Francisco Chronicle who wrote that review. I won't.
Elizabeth Greenwood, John. It was Elizabeth Greenwood.
Well, yeah, it was really nice. Thank you. Because I used to be a book reviewer, I'm uncomfortable with like thanking book reviewers, because when people would email me and thank me, I would be like, listen, I didn't write that because I wanted to make you happy.
Exactly.
And I don't want you to get mad at me next time when I don't like your book. I think we should just not have a personal relationship.
That's not, this is not what this is about.
Oh, so at least the initial reviews are good. Hank, let's answer some questions from our listeners after we remind them one more time that The Anthropocene Reviewed is available now. Signed copies are everywhere books are sold, and also everywhere books are lent. Check out your local library.
So, John, now it is time to ask some questions from our listeners, but not before I remind everyone that The Anthropocene Reviewed is available wherever books are stored, wherever books are sold, not stored, and also probably most places where they're stored, and also including places where those books are lent, like your local library.
All right, Hank, let's read our first question. This one comes from Autumn, who writes, Dear John and Hank, my name is Autumn, and I am confused. Growing up, my mom always made me eat the crust of my bread because, quote, it is the healthiest part of the bread. But what? How? It's made of the same ingredients as the rest of the bread, right? Unless there's something fundamental I fail to understand about bread making. It's just cooked a little more. So how is it healthier? Not the other seasons, Autumn.
I mean, it's not exactly chemically the same, I will say. And there was a study back in like almost 20 years ago now that like looked at the different ingredients, the different nutrients or the different chemicals, not even nutrients, chemicals in the crust versus in the bread. And there are some different chemicals, and some of them are antioxidants. And so you can make the case that maybe these are is slightly healthy. It's not. It's not. It is nutritionally the same as the rest of the bread, but it is food that people and our planet worked hard together to create. Also a plant. The plant also worked very hard to create it. And so we should eat it because it's food. And so we tell ourselves and our children lies, and we say that it's the healthiest part of the bread and you should eat it, despite the fact that it's not. It's a lie, but it's a lie in service of the fact that we should eat food that it was that is edible. And in fact, my son makes me cut his crusts off his freaking peanut butter jelly sandwich, and I eat them.
Me too. Because it's fact, it's one of my favorite meals is my kids' peanut butter and jelly crusts. I also think that sometimes the nutritional profile of crust in bread is changed further by the fact that the crust does have different ingredients in it, like certain kinds
sometimes
of bread
true.
Have, you know, like egg on them or whatever.
An egg wash, or even like are dusted with little nuts.
Right. But at its core, when people say the crust is healthier, even when they're pointing to this one study from 20 years ago, it's important to note that the difference is so marginal.
Oh, yeah. No, nothing.
And we get obsessed with these really truly insignificant differences all the time when it comes to nutrition, rather than focusing on where we should actually focus, which is like eat food, pay attention to how your body feels when you eat food, and period.
You are absolutely right, and it is also very true that like the way that we imagine what is healthy is it's very weird. It's and it's the white egg brown egg thing where you feel like a brown egg is healthier. Like in what where did that happen? How did this occur? Where people a bunch of chicken farmers had to switch chickens so that they could like have a different color of egg that is nutritionally identical.
Yeah,
it's wild.
We live in a world where branding is so important that it's hard sometimes for us to disambiguate branding from reality because
and we're pattern searchers, so we're and it's what is true is that potato, there are more vitamins and minerals in potato skin than in the potato part of the potato.
Yes.
And so it like went from that to being like, eggs, brown eggs must have more, because you don't even eat the shell. Yeah. It's not even part of the bird you eat.
Right. But on the other hand, like, it could also go, you also see this in the whole thing about drinking 8 glasses of water per day, which is completely made up.
God. Yes.
But is based on something, right? It's based on drink water.
when you are thirsty.
That actually is good advice. Now, the vast majority of people can just drink water when they're thirsty, but there is some very small subset of people who mm-hmm. have to pay attention to the amount of water they drink and when they drink it and so on. But mm-hmm. for almost everyone, almost yes. all of the time, you drink water and that's good. And that's the end of the sentence. Like, I remember when we were doing 100 days, mm-hmm. we went to these nutritionists and to people who, you know, had studied all of the most recent compelling studies in nutrition science. And one of the things we learned is that a lot of these studies are based on relatively short time periods with relatively small groups of people. And so they're...
And often very similar people.
Yeah. And so their results can be compelling without necessarily really reshaping the way we understand nutrition. Mm-hmm. And that has all kinds of downstream effects. But I was like, so I want to be maximally healthy for 100 days. So like, what does the evidence strongly suggest I should do? How much water should I drink to maximize my health? Yeah. And I'll drink that amount of water every day for 100 days. Yeah. And the experts were like, what, huh? You should drink when you're thirsty. And I was I should only drink water, right? And they were like, no, I mean, do drink water, but I don't, if you like to drink coffee, that's fine.
Yeah. But doesn't it dehydrate you? No.
A little bit, but just drink a little bit of water.
Yeah. It will hydrate you slightly less than water. It will not dehydrate you. It's not like drinking the ocean. It is almost as if water in particular is so vitally important for your body that your body has really good systems for telling you when to consume it.
Right. But I do think like we want, and this is partly, I think, gets into this sort of collective delusion around nutrition and health. But we want nutrition to be able to solve all of our health problems.
Right.
Or to be able to, we want nutrition to be the key that unlocks all of human health forever.
Yeah. And yeah. Not even like our fitness problems, but we also want to cure cancer with it and we want to not get COVID with it. And like, right. you think like, I'm putting this stuff in my body. Shouldn't it be able to control all of these things that I can't control? And it's just, no, it's unfortunately, alas. It cannot.
Yeah. Alas, it really doesn't. And that's kind of a tough thing. And also, like, that message doesn't get spread that widely, partly because it's not a particularly lucrative message.
No, you know? It's not an interesting one either. Yeah.
And it's also not that interesting, right? Like, mm-hmm. So stories around wellness and around, like, oh, you know, life transforming because of eating certain supplements or something. And there may be anecdotal experiences of that are very true, and I don't want to deny the reality of those people's experience. But mm-hmm. when looked at on a macro level, there's just not very strong evidence for much of it. So
yeah.
Drink water when you're thirsty. Eat the crust of the bread not because it's healthier, but because it's food.
It's food. We worked hard to create it. And John, this next question comes from Jason, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, a Dear John letter is a letter to a romantic partner announcing the end of a relationship." So,
yes, I am aware. Believe me.
What would a Dear Hank letter be? Dear Hank and John seems like the right place to ask this question. What do we all need to tell Hank? With Argonauts, Jason. What is it?
I think we need to get to the question part of this question. But first, okay. I just need to say something, which is that everybody who emails me, and they begin the email by "Dear John," and then there's a paragraph about how it's funny to be writing a Dear John letter because that's a breakup letter, but this isn't a breakup letter. It's a letter to a person named John. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but I've heard the joke.
Right. Well, and also at this point, do we even use that phrase anymore?
I feel like the only time we use that phrase is in a Nicholas Sparks movie that came out 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then when people are emailing me, those are the only times I see the colloquial meaning of Dear John used.
I have to shout out to anybody who remembers this theme song, which for some reason is in my head. Mm-hmm. Dear John, dear John, by the time you read these lines, I'll be gone. It was like
God, what is that?
It was like an 80s sitcom.
Is it from My Two Dads?
No, it was a show called Dear John.
Oh, no way.
Yes.
No, I would remember if there was a show called Dear John Hank.
Yes, and it had that guy in it. That guy who's still famous. He's still doing stuff.
No.
Yes.
No way.
It's Judd Hirsch.
Oh, my God. It has that guy in it.
He's in everything. He's still doing it.
That guy. Apparently, Dear John was on American television from 1988 to 1992, four of my peak television watching years.
Totally.
I have no memory of this program. I'm sure I saw it a million times because when you sang that song, something came back to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that that's part of the reason why in the 1990s, like when my friends and I would write letters, they would always be like, it's not that kind of Dear John letter.
Right.
Oh, I wonder if it's good.
John, for the Project for Awesome this year, do you want to do a commentary of Dear John? Because you can just watch it on YouTube. It is just available.
Yeah. You know, like the streaming rights to Friends sold for $50 billion or whatever, but the streaming rights to Dear John, like they couldn't get a 5-cent offer. So they were like, I guess we'll just upload them.
Right. The top comment on Dear John Pilot Season 1, Episode 1 is from Tom Willett. He says, I am Tom Willett. I was Tom in this series. It's great to see the pilot again. The cast was fabulous to be with for the 4 seasons of the show. The entire crew and production company was all first class. We did this at Paramount. The pilot was originally written for the UK where the series began. We worked on this from 1988 until 1992. I wish they would release this on DVD. Thanks for posting this 8 years ago.
That's great.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Tom Willett. I was Tom in this series.
It makes me think that like 40 years from now, when people start like re-uploading Vlogbrothers videos to whatever exists after the collapse of civilization and YouTube falls apart, we're going to come across like a re-uploaded Vlogbrothers video and be like, oh, hey, thanks for posting this. I remember.
Thank you for sharing this.
We made this in my basement in Indianapolis for 17 years in the before times, and it was so fun. Then, of course, there was the tremendous amount of destruction that we wrought. We're really sorry about that. And thanks for posting. Anyway, I got to go now because I have to light the ring of fire that I use each evening to protect my home from the zombie horde. But it's really nice to see these old videos.
Glad we're getting the internet back online. Looks good. Thanks for saving those.
Yeah, thanks to whoever downloaded Vlogbrothers videos onto a hard drive and saw this whole zombie apocalypse thing coming.
My God. Boy, I tell you what's not on a hard drive somewhere is almost all Vlogbrothers videos.
Yeah, gosh. Makes me think we should go through and download them.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. John, do you want to actually answer this question at all?
Yes, because I think it's a great question, and I'm sorry we got sidetracked by deeply early 90s TV. Yeah. What would a Dear Hank letter be? I've got
me to answer the question because I know exactly what it would be because I receive them all the time. Dear Hank, where does the wax go when the candle burns?
No. I mean, like, a Dear Hank letter has to be like a universal letter. If a Dear John letter is, this just isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. I'm leaving. I think a Dear Hank letter is, I have long harbored a deep love for you that I am now revealing in this letter.
Oh, okay. Is it like, does it come along with a Dear John letter where it's like, you're leaving one person for the best friend?
No. Dear Hank letter is the letter that you write where you're like, I'm just going to say it. I've been thinking it for 15 years. I'm going to reveal these feelings to my best friend and we'll see how it goes. And then, of course, the Dear John letter is the letter that you get in response.
That's not what I... I don't know that that's what... Like, if I could pick... Here's what I pick for any letter to be a Dear Hank letter. It would be a letter that you write to a person who you want nothing from, but want... And they are relatively minor player in your life, but a person who you see in the real world. Yeah. And it is just letting them know that you appreciate something about them. But it has to be someone who you want nothing from. So a Dear Hank letter is like to the person that you see at the grocery store sometimes who has very good shoes. or yes. or like the person who has a very clever license plate, personalized license plate, and you leave it on their front of their window and you say, I just wanted you to know, I see this license plate around town and it makes me smile every time. I want nothing from you. And that's
maybe don't include that sentence because nothing sounds more like you want something from them than like it sounds almost right. like a threat.
Leave
like, I don't want anything from you. Why would you think that? Just say, yeah, I really do like that idea. That's a great idea for a Dear Hank letter. And I have to say, I've been writing more thank you notes in the last few years. And one, somebody in the Anthropocene Reviewed email told me once that thank you notes are a double mercy. Because they bring mercy to the writer and to the reader. And I thought that was so beautiful and so true. Like, I feel better after I write a thank you note. So I love the idea that it's a thank you note, but it has to be a thank you note from somebody, even if you dig deep down into your heart, you do not want anything from. It is a true thank you note.
Yeah, that is good. And it is a thing that I know that you do much more effectively than I do. Because I don't form habits that are healthy. Thank you very much.
All right, Hank, we have another question. This one comes from Julia. It gets right back to the heart of when we started this whole business. Dear John and Hank, I've been binging Vlogbrothers videos lately, and I was reminded of the fact that John was the one who suggested the idea of a collaborative video blog. Let's just take a second to be grateful for that. I mean, where would we be, Hank?
Write a little thank
where
you note right now.
Where would we be?
John's writing a thank you note to himself, so that's good.
Oh, and it's a Dear Hank letter because I really don't want anything of myself. I just want to say thank you. My question is, how did John, a person who is generally anxious and stressed about public speaking and interacting with others, become excited about blasting videos and images of himself to the entire internet? Pumpkins and Penguins, Julia.
I don't really know. I don't really get it. But it was very different back then. Like, it was never like a moment when it all suddenly felt like lots of people were looking at us, because there wasn't really a moment where our audience grew dramatic. Like now with TikTok, you have like many people have like 8 videos on their TikTok and one of them has 1 million views and the rest of them have 100. And whereas when we like when in the sort of beginning times of this, it was like every video would get the same number of views forever. It was what it felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe slightly increasing over time.
Yeah. I mean, the first like 150 or so Vlogbrothers videos we made got an average of around 400 or 500 views. And so I know it's hard to like think back to those times, but I didn't think I was... So there's two things at work. One is that I am anxious in social situations, but... making a video blog is not a social situation. It's something that you do
extremely
alone.
Controlled.
Yeah, you do it alone in your basement and you have complete control over every facet of the process. And that was very appealing to me. I do not like being on television because it is not like that. And then number two is that it was just smaller. Like the world of the internet was smaller and it felt... Mm. Like a world that was separate from the real world.
Yeah.
And so I think both those things were at work. But like, to be clear, just because you're an anxious person doesn't mean that you aren't like desperate for outside affirmation. And I think, you know, part of the reason I started writing books probably was because I wanted to tell stories to an audience, but I wanted to be able to like not, you know, have to go outside to do that, not have to perform to do that. But the other thing is that I like performing. Like I do get very anxious before Hank and I go on stage if we're performing, and sometimes it can be really difficult for me, but I enjoy it. I get a lot out of it. Like I've said this before, but I love being on stage with Hank because it's so unpredictable. I have no idea what's going to happen. There's a terror in that, but there's also a wonder in it. And I also know that like I'm on stage with someone who is like, you know, gonna save me if I start to bomb. Like, I do feel pretty intensely anxious when it's just me on stage and there's not much, you know, I don't really get a big kick out of that really. But I'll do it if I need to do it for work, like if it's an important part of selling a book or something. Like, I, before we started Vlogbrothers, I did it to help sell books, and I don't know, it wasn't something I really sought out, but I was okay doing it. So in my case, anxiety and OCD manifests itself in certain ways. And for a long time, videos just weren't even part of that. Like, my life making videos was completely separate from my life experiencing anxiety. And then that changed, and it was a difficult thing to deal with the change.
Right. Yeah.
Because it did begin to become a source of anxiety for me, and it took much, much longer to make a Vlogbrothers video because it took much longer to, like, say the words that were in the video. And, you know, but that's okay. Like, I just make space to accommodate it. And so I still really love making Vlogbrothers videos. It brings me a lot of joy. I also have to sometimes accommodate this, like, thing that I do where I repeat what I say, or, like, can't get through a sentence because I get nervous or trip up or whatever, but that's fine. I've made space for it.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, the things that I would think would be the cause of the greatest stress and anxiety for you are not necessarily those things, which just goes to show that, like, the ways that I try to imagine other people's brains is always going to be a little bit or a lot wrong. You know, I would imagine that just the idea of, like, putting ideas out there that people might misinterpret, or that they, or that, like, they might be wrong, like, that would be the thing that would be the, like, chief focus, because that's like sort of what I have the most anxiety about. And I know you have anxiety about that too, but it isn't the same kind of obsessive anxiety that you have around other things.
Yeah. And I think, like, that can be a difficult thing for people who aren't inside the experience to imagine. But the example that I always use is that the White River is really, really filthy. It's profoundly contaminated. I've gotten Giardia from it twice. But I do not have anxiety about kayaking on the White River. Because for one thing, I know that if I get Giardia, I'll be fine.
I've done that. I know what that's like.
So, you know, I have all of these, I have health fears, I have all of these obsessive fears about contamination, but I'm able to do this thing that doesn't make sense to people, a lot of people, because they're like, well, you have an obsessive fear of contamination, why would you stick your butt in the most contaminated place in Indianapolis? And the answer is because the worries are not rational.
If it made sense, it wouldn't be a disorder.
Right. Yeah. Like, my disordered thinking is disordered.
Yeah.
Whereas my thinking about the White River is very reasonable. I'm like, yeah, it's dirty, but, like, oh, it's going to be lovely to be down there.
Right. John, I have a question I want to answer because it's fascinating, and I did not know this until Boki looked it up when she saw the question. And it's from Bailey, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, why do cats and dogs always sniff in short little sniffs? Why don't they take one big sniff the way that we do when we smell something? Your friendly building and loan, Bailey." So, John, it turns out we take one big sniff to breathe things in because our sniff areas are on the way to the lungs, whereas dogs and cats take lots of little sniffs because their sniff areas are separate things that exist off to the side. So air can go two different ways. It can go into the sniff areas, and it can go all the way down into the lungs to breathe. And about 12% of the air goes into sniff areas. And then they breathe out through a separate hole, kind of. It's the same hole. But so, like, you see the dog nose has, like, the nostrils, and then there are, like, slits that kind of curl up to the side that makes them super cute. That's like the area that air is exhaled out of, where it is inhaled through the holes. And this allows them to store air in the sniff areas and have it sit there for longer so that they can smell the stuff that's, like, sitting in there, rather than us having to, like, breathe in constantly to have more of the same air going past our sniff areas before we blow it all out with air that just smells like our lungs.
Wow. That is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It would be so different to be a dog.
It would be very different to be a dog. Though there's a dog I follow on TikTok that makes me think it's not that different.
Yes,
Have you seen
TikTok
Bunny?
TikTok is the great equalizer. Hey, can I ask you a question about this?
Yeah.
So one time, this only happened one time, but one time I went to, like, a wine tasting, okay? And the wine tasting guy, the sommelier, is that the word?
Yep.
Well, the sommelier was like, so I want you to smell the wine. I want you to inhale deeply and smell the wine. And then they always ask you, like, it's a pop quiz. Like, what do you smell? And the only answer that I ever have in my heart is I smell wine, you know, and I'm trying to smell other stuff. But like, really, it smells so much like wine. It's hard to pay attention to anything else that it might smell like. Mm-hmm. And then we swished the glass around. And then he wanted us to take short, quick scents. Like we're
a doggy.
I've always wondered why he did that. And I did. I was like, well, when I do that, you know what? It still smells like wine. But I did it. And I always wondered, like, why he had us do that, if there was anything to it. Or maybe he was just like, these people are such rank amateurs that I can tell them anything.
And you should have been like, look, sir, I'm not a dog. I don't have a separate sniff pocket.
Yeah, I should have. That's because you really, one thing you definitely want to do at a wine tasting is annoy the sommelier.
This happened to me once. I had a glass and I usually have nothing to say. I'm like, wow, this tastes like grapes. And it has overtones of grape. And then I said, oh, this, like, I drank and I was like, you know what that tastes and smells a little like is gunpowder. And the guy said, no. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He was like mad at me. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I'm wrong.
Yeah. I usually try to express myself rather than with words, with sounds, like,
sure.
And then I feel like I can, like, if I taste one wine and then I taste another wine, I can be like,
is not the same.
Yes, yes, I can be like, I have noticed a difference. I can't articulate it super well, but one of them is sort
of
more, and the other is sort of less. One of them tastes like big, and the other one tastes a little smaller.
That's how it works. It's all about metaphor. For clarity, I've been in one wine tasting in my life. So
I think I was there with you.
Yeah, you were. That was with our parents.
God, that was a fun trip.
It was fun. You know, John, this conversation has reminded me of one of our sponsors, which is Separate Sniff Pockets. Sniff Pockets. They are fantastic. Only dogs and sommeliers have them.
That is one kind of virtual reality headset I would definitely sign up for. If they could, like, make me have a more sophisticated sense of smell, I mean, if that's the Oculus 3, take my money. Today's podcast is also, of course, brought to you by Tom Willett, who played Tom on the 1980s and 1990s sitcom Dear John.
Tom Willett. This podcast is also brought to you by John's press tour for the Anthropocene Reviewed. It is about to begin, and John is going to be stressed out all day. And so enjoy your day, John. You're going to do good.
Well, I wish it was only one day.
You're going to...
Okay. That would be nice. And I do try to remind myself that there were several books where I did not have press tours. And
no one cared.
I have a lot to be grateful for.
Yeah.
The fact that a newspaper wants to talk to me is great news. And so I'm trying to focus on that side of things. Lastly, our podcast is, of course, brought to you by Dear Hank Letters. Dear Hank Letters, an exciting new product coming soon from DFTBA.com that will allow you to write thank you letters to people from whom you genuinely want nothing. Because, Hank, I think it's one thing to have an idea, but it's not really an idea until there's a capitalist motivation for it. And so I think we need to release the first ever Dear Hank letter note cards if we want this idea to take off.
No.
I agree. Not least because we can't be advertising anything when we are advertising the Anthropocene Review.
John, we have a Project for Awesome message. It's from Rachel and Ben from Tulsa to Judo, Leo, Elena, Elijah, and Sky. To our curious little nerd fighters, keep striving to understand the world in all of its beauty. Your mom and dad are proud of who you are and who you are becoming. You've lived through interesting times, and yet you stand full of wonder. Keep going. Continue to love well and live fully. The world will be stronger for it. John and Hank, thanks for impacting another generation for good. That's very sweet. Also, that's you appear great. To have a great number of children.
Also, phenomenal names. So Judah, mm-hmm. Leo, Elena, Elijah, and Sky, we wish you well. Mm-hmm. We're sorry that we didn't make a better world for you, but we have every confidence that you are going to make a better world for those who come after.
Yes.
So we all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but one thing you don't want to compromise on is your health. When it comes to your health, there should be no compromising. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines or their family group chat or the crossword puzzle just because they're available right now, or take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. You can search by location, availability, and insurance. So literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. So go to ZocDoc.com/DearHank and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/DearHank. ZocDoc.com/DearHank.
Hank, before we get to the all-important news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon, I really want to ask this wonderful question that came in from Caitlin that I do not know the answer to, and which has real import for what I want my future as a person to look like. Caitlin writes, "Dear John and Hank, in your last podcast, you mentioned that the Martian sky is filled with dust and has a brown daytime sky vibe. I'm allergic to many things on Earth, particularly pollen and dust, and I was sad to learn about the extensive dust on Mars. I had hoped when we moved to Mars that I would no longer have allergies and would therefore be able to discontinue my allergy medication." I assume this is the main reason people want to visit Mars. And so I thought it was very important, Hank, that we get to the bottom of the question. Will we have allergies on Mars?
So there has been some thinking about this. I think mostly in the sort of science fiction world, often what you hear is that there are still allergens, but there are fewer. And the big problem is when people come back to Earth, they are not used to the allergens of Earth, and so have tremendous allergies on Earth. And I think that that's just sort of like, that's part of a way that science, like it's a trope in science fiction to emphasize that we become not Earth people when we leave Earth. And coming right. back to the Earth, there's sort of a tension. Some science fiction authors argue that, like, ultimately when you come back, you are finally being exposed to the world that you were built for, and you are very comfortable in it, and you find that you've kind of been uncomfortable your whole life, versus other sci-fi authors who make the case that, like, you will, and this is certainly the case when it comes to changes in gravity, that when you come back to Earth, it will actually be really terrible and you will be incapable of functioning here. So that's what I know from, like, sci-fi books, which talk about allergies a surprising amount. Now, the dust that you are allergic to on Earth it is likely to be not just dust generally. It's likely to be a component of the dust. There are many different components of the dust. There could be several different components of the dust that you might be allergic to. But a lot of dust is just like pieces of carpet and furniture and clothes. And if you're not allergic to your own, like the cotton in your shirt, then you're not allergic to some of the dust, because a lot of the dust is just cotton particles. Now, it may be that you're mostly allergic to dust mites, in which case you would not be allergic to the outside of, or the leavings of dust mites. You would not be allergic to the outside of Mars, but you would absolutely be allergic to the inside of whatever habitat you were living in, because we're taking dust mites with us, whether we want them or not. And the same goes for mold. We're taking mold with us, whether we want it or not. And oftentimes, even on space stations, mold has been a problem already. Mm-hmm. Existing space mm-hmm. stations that we have now. So mm-hmm. you will likely be allergic where you end up. It will probably not be the Martian dust finds that you will be allergic to. It will be the stuff that we bring with us. So I have bad news regardless.
Also, at least as I understand it, it's not like you're going to be able to get that allergic to the Martian dust because you're not going to be interacting. You're not going to be like breathing it in very often because you're not going to be like romping around Mars, you know, breathing in the air that isn't there.
Actually, you probably will be breathing in the dust quite a bit because there will not be a way to keep it out of the habitats because it is so sticky and tiny. That it will. It'll get into the airlock, and then it'll get from the airlock into the habitat, and it'll be a whole battle to fight. And it's also now another problem is that the dust, like it, I would be more worried about the components of the dust, which may include like it may be sharp, and so like asbestosy, where it could harm your lungs, or you know if there's like chemical compounds in the dust, like perchlorates, that would be bad to breathe in. This is one of the main concerns with when it comes to Mars is that there are some chemicals in the dust that humans are not well suited to encountering regularly. So it may be that Mars will be kind of off the table because of that. But we're operating right now as if it will not be the case. So we'll see.
I'm really excited for humans to go to Mars, and I think it will be one of the great achievements of our species. Probably top five.
Sure.
But I will say that the more you talk about what human life on Mars might look like, the more I think, wow, is Earth a good planet? I mean, what a great planet.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, no one talks about the toxicity of the soil on Mars, which does seem like a really big deal. Like toxic soil is a big problem. And this isn't just a problem for like growing plants in it. Like you could not grow potato plants in Martian soil unless you like washed it a lot. Mm. But like also you have to have systems for keeping it out of the areas that people exist inside of because it's very bad for you.
Yeah. I mean, Earth is just, I've been thinking this more and more. Like, I really have been trying to orient myself toward wonder because it just makes life so much more enjoyable. And in those moments when I'm able to do it, I'm like, wow, this is great. Like, like this river is amazing. If we like discovered the White River on Europa tomorrow, everyone would be like, oh my God, what a river.
whoa.
Wait, so your big concern is that it's got a little too much nitrogen and, you know, like a little smidge of Giardia here and there? Like,
Giardia on Europa would be a very big deal. Be the coolest, exactly. Most exciting Giardia we've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, it would be hilarious if the first life that is discovered on a planet outside of Earth is literally just E. coli. I mean, that stuff really, it really can't make it anywhere.
It is not impossible. There are people who think that is maybe even likely. We will find life somewhere else and it'll have straight up mitochondria and we'll be like, oh, dang it. That's just us again.
Well, we'll be like, oh, dang it. But we'll also be like, oh, whoa.
Yeah, it's also exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is no version of finding life that is definitely from another planet that is not incredibly exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's one version, which is that it's the last moment for humanity.
It then spreads and just like eats all of our eyeballs until we're...
I didn't mean like microscopic life. I meant like if sentient life comes here and they're like, this is a good planet, but y'all have not done a great job with it. So we're going to go ahead and...
this is ours now. Thanks.
Yeah, we're going to go ahead and settle in on this one.
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard, but your core is got a lot of iron and we need to build a Dyson sphere. So we're going to need that.
Yeah. That's a bad version, but like all the versions where humanity discovers life on another planet or finds like strong evidence of life that we're able to observe closely is incredibly exciting because we don't know what we don't know about extraterrestrial life. And anytime something like that happens, it's so exciting. I just want to have one moment of like that in my life where there is such big news about our understanding of the universe that my mind just.
It could happen. You got some time left.
I know. Well, hopefully we'll see.
Or maybe it's just the White River.
Maybe it's just the White River, which is also that's also been a great joy. Hank.
Yes.
I want to talk about the news from AFC Wimbledon. It's always exciting. It's never not exciting. But I just have to acknowledge that the football team that I have loved since I was a child, Liverpool Football Club, had a game over the weekend.
It was wild.
In which it's a game that we had to win in order to have a chance to qualify for the Champions League. And so with the last kick of the game, we brought the goalie up, which is something that teams do, but it never works. Like,
yeah,
Liverpool
like
had
been
a football club for 130 years.
So it was a tie? It was like tied?
It was tied.
Well, was it an exciting game before that? Sorry, can I get a little more context? Was it 0-0? Like, had you been losing? Had you been winning?
It was 1-1. We went down 1-0, and then Mohamed Salah tied the game. So it was 1-1 in the 94th minute. It was going to be the last kick of the game, this corner kick. So they brought up the goalie, Alisson, a Brazilian guy who's a lovely person and also has had a horrible, horrible year. He lost his father in a terrible accident earlier, just a couple months ago, and he hasn't been able to go home to Brazil, so he hasn't been able to grieve with his family, and it's just been very, very difficult. And so the other piece of background here that's important is that Liverpool have been a football club for like 130 years, and no goalies have ever scored for Liverpool in that 130 years. That's how much this whole, like, bring up the goalkeeper for the last kick of the game, that's how much it never works. Except that it did work. It did work. Alisson scored not just a goal, but a really magnificent goal.
It was beautiful.
Afterwards. Yeah.
It was not an accident. There was another body there. He's like 8 inches taller than everybody else down there. Yeah. It looked like to me. He's a big guy.
He is.
And the header was just like textbook.
Oh, it was
the
phenomenal.
The goalie for the other side just stood there. Was yeah. like, well, not getting that.
It went into the side netting. The Liverpool, yeah. I mean, I have never felt like that. I was
You were
alone
watching live?
House. Yeah, I was alone in the house, thank God. And I was so discouraged and I was so frustrated that we weren't going to qualify for the Champions League and all that means for the club financially. And I was so mad. I was mad about this whole European Super League, which distracted the club at a critical time. I was just mad.
Mm-hmm.
And then Alisson scored this goal, and I mean, I don't know that I will ever feel like that ever again. I don't even know what happened inside my body.
It's like they found E. coli on Europa.
It was that. It was just pure joy. So happy for Alisson.
94 in 13 and 20 seconds.
Oh, was,
how
I mean,
long
yeah,
do the games was, last? That's was, longer was, than they said it was going to last.
I know. It was pure magic. But let's talk about AFC Wimbledon, Hank.
okay.
America's favorite third-tier English football team is once again going to be a third-tier English football team, thanks to some absolute end-of-season heroics by manager Mark Robertson and the boys. Couple big pieces of news. Number one, 19-year-old wonder kid Ayub Assal has signed a new professional contract with Wimbledon that will take him through 2024, which is key because if he continues to get better at the current rate that he's getting better, there is no way he is going to play for us much longer.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful to him for signing that contract. The other thing is that even though the league season is over, Wimbledon are still participating in this thing called the London Senior Cup. It's like the under-23 team, kind of the younger kids are playing in this this knockout cup competition. And we have reached the finals of that competition. In the quarterfinals, we beat, you cannot make this up, a team called Cockfosters.
It's real, and, yeah.
And in this, I'm sure that's a place in England because why wouldn't it be? And in the semifinals, we beat noted footballing powerhouse Cray Villy Paper Mills Football Club. Now we move on to the finals. This is the first chance Wimbledon has had to win any silverware in some time. This would be, you know, like a proper trophy. It's not quite as good as like winning the Premier League, but it is something. And I am very excited to see if we can pull out a win in the London Senior Cup.
Okay, good. Is that how likely is that?
You know, I mean, I think it's pretty likely. Like last year, it was won by Peckham Town. I don't know. I feel like we could beat the likes of
they
Peckham
did it.
Town.
You can do it. Yeah.
This is the stuff I have to keep me going during the long silly season that is the off season. So, what's the news from Mars? They don't quit playing in the summer.
No, they don't. Boy, I've just spent the last while you were talking there, just watching Alison Becker score that goal over and over again. And it's amazing.
Oh,
that
it's so magical.
I don't know who this other guy is.
He just collapses into tears.
Oh, yeah. It's no, just, he's crying. He's like praying to the sky, talking to his dad. I can tell he's talking to his dad, and it's something else. But yeah.
Yeah, he lifts his fingers up to the sky, and he says in Portuguese, he says, barely say it now. Yeah. He said, "That's for you, Dad."
Yeah. Is this other other Liverpool player like dives in and like comes right in front of Becker and has this tremendous leap and he's headed straight for the ball and he's like, yeah, and it just like doesn't even touch him.
Yeah.
Right over his, yeah, and then like just giant Alison Becker is just there with his head in the exact right spot. It worked. Oh. It worked. It feels so good. It feels so good.
It's just magical. Just magical. Yeah, the guy who was running for it and like took that great leap was Nat Phillips, our hardworking central defender. But
he really flew. He was flying and he just
he did. He was he was doing everything right. Whereas Allison was just like, I think I'm gonna let the ball hit my head, and then I think the ball's gonna go in the net.
Oh God bless sports. Well, sports. There's also good news in Mars. So far as of a couple of weeks ago, only ever been one country who's managed to land a rover on Mars. It's been the US. We've done it a number of times. It is a hard planet. And as a species, we are getting better at this. And as of last week, as of now, there is now a second nation that has put a rover on Mars. It's the Zhurong rover that the Chinese National Space Administration has landed on Mars. It's been orbiting the planet for a while. So Tianwen-1 is the orbiter that is still orbiting. And since February, it's been like taking pictures to make sure it's got a good spot for this thing to land. Went down, landed safely. It is the mission is going as planned. It looks good. You will, if you look at Zhurong, you will think that's familiar because it looks very much like Spirit and Opportunity, which is sort of just a convergent evolution. Like if you want a thing to fold up into a certain shape, you want a mast with scientific instruments on the top of it. You want six wheels that are sort of like have independent transmission. And so like all of that stuff sort of comes together to make a rover that looks similar and has a similar shape. The solar panels also kind of function similarly. So it's but it's another opportunity to survey another area of Mars. It's a big planet. So any opportunity, it doesn't have the same sort of suite of instruments as Perseverance, of course, which is like probably at least 10 times the mass of Zhurong. But it's, you know, it's got another opportunity to learn about a different spot on Mars, get more beautiful high resolution pictures. And it will be working for at least 90 Martian days, which is basically the same as the Earth day, a little bit longer. And it's got cameras and it's got some spectroscopy equipment. It's going to be studying the weather. It's going to be studying some rocks. And it will be working with its orbiter to send all that data back to Earth. And it is China's first Mars landing and the first rover landing of any country except for the U.S. It's basically the first successful landing from any country except the U.S. Russia had a lander that landed successfully, but then broke within a day, which was a bummer.
That is a bummer.
Yeah, but it looks like we're figuring it out.
I'm very happy that there is another rover on Mars. Is this probably going to be the last one because I assume Mars and Earth are getting further apart, right, and so it's harder to send them?
Yeah, so Chunwen arrived at the same time, basically, as Perseverance, because there's sort of a two-year window when you can launch. So that this is the last of the spate of missions. But of course, like, their missions continue, and there will be news from both of these rovers as we go on.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And it's great to have more people getting involved in space exploration and interplanetary travel. Am I correct in assuming that it will be another like year and a half before we can make the next round of these Earth to Mars missions?
Yeah, I think a year and a half will be the time when you will hear about a bunch more Mars missions launching. And we know what those are, but like, it's not like they plan them in less than 2 years. But
right.
So, yeah, we are aware of which missions those will be, but they will not be launching. I think that they will be launching in 2022 or 23.
I'm excited too.
Those launch times are very exciting and busy, and it's crazy that they sort of also all arrive at the same time. And they're like, "Hey, we're here. We're back, Mars. How's it going? Launch. We got close together again." So,
yeah, I love it. Oh, well, Hank, thank you for potting with me. Thanks to everybody for listening. You can email us your questions at hankandjohn@gmail.com. We really appreciate your questions. We're off to record our Patreon-only podcast, This Week in Stuff. I hope you like the Anthropocene Reviewed book. Hey, if you buy the book, by the way, go to theanthropocenereviewed.com, a website that I am very glad now that I didn't buy. because two nerdfighters have made a wonderful website there. Their names are Jim and Rhett, and they built a website that allows you to post where your book ended up. And also, if you take a picture of your signature, I can see your signature, which will make me really happy because I like to look at them and rank them in my mind. But it also
Not your signature, but the one that you received from John.
Yeah. Sorry, my signature that is now yours, because that's how the transaction works. But it also allows you to review the place where you are reading the book, like review the town or the state or the whatever community in which you are reading the book. And those have been so lovely to read. It's really great. And I'm just so grateful to them for making that. So if you have a chance to share where your book ended up and what it looks like, it would make me super happy. TheAnthropoceneReviewed.com.
John, this podcast is edited by Joseph Tunametish. It's produced by Rosianna Halsrohas and Sheridan Gibson. Our communications coordinator is Julia Bloom. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now and at the beginning of the podcast is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.